Welcome back to the Pilots Lounge. On today's episode, we are joined by Royal Australian Air Force Top Gun, as well as Red Bull Air Race World Champion, Matt Hall. Matt shares with us his upbringing and how he got into aviation through the military and what eventually led him to get involved with the Red Bull Air Race series. This is an episode you're not going to want to miss, so be sure to hang out until the end. He shares incredible insight both for flying and for life from wherever you are at. Sit back, grab your cup of coffee, and as always, thanks again for joining us on the Pilots Lounge.
What's going on, Bertellian? This is John Gray, host of the Hangar Z podcast. We love the Pilots Lounge podcast and know you do as well. Hey, when you're done here, come check out the Hangar Z podcast. We're the first and only podcast promoting the personnel and equipment behind the missions in public safety aviation. You can find us at hangarzpodcast.com or anywhere where you listen to podcasts.
I know we all hate ads, but we also all hate trying to organize these mass custom apparel orders for our organization. So head over to www.brotellian.com and let us make that process easy for you. We'll work with you to design a logo, or if you already have one, we'll set up a unit page where people can go and order the items they want shipped directly to them. So that way your organization can focus on what matters. Again, www.brotellian.com. Welcome back to the Pilots Lounge. On today's episode, we are joined by Matthew Hall, famed Red Bull Air Race pilot and former F-18 pilot with the Royal Australian Air Force, who is also the author of the book, The Sky is Not the Limit. Matt comes to us with over 7,500 flight hours across gliders, ultralights, hang gliders, powered aircraft, helicopters, military jets, and more. Matt, welcome.
Thanks, guys. Great to be here.
We're super excited to have you on. Kind of before we kick off things and talk specifically about your story, something that we do here on the Pilots Lounge, which is probably our favorite part, is called table talk. Now I don't know how the Australian Air Force does things, but in the Army we have, you know, table talk with that instructor pilot where they pretty much put you through the ringer and grill you with typically sometimes not so fun questions regarding either your flight or emergency procedures or whatever it might be. But on the podcast, we do things a little bit differently. We just use that as sort of a way for us to ask any and all questions from categories of our choosing to kind of get everybody in their creative juices flowing and everybody comfortable. So I will let Spence probably kick off with the first question.
Yeah. So favorite bar you've been to anywhere in the world?
Jeez, favorite bar. That's a tough one. Oceana, Naval Air Station at Oceana. That was pretty up there for wild and crazy. Also the bar at the O's Club at Nellis Air Force Base for a weapons school graduation was right up there. And
okay,
we had things to write home about.
Did you guys hit up the Strip after that down in Vegas?
Yes, we did.
My man.
So following that up, so we know you were born in 1971, and we won't bring age into it, but something that Brett, one of our other co-hosts, likes to typically ask is, are people's favorite movies from the year they were born? And of these movies from 1971, which would you choose? The first being Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, Dirty Harry, Fiddler on the Roof, in the movie Walkabout.
And Dirty Harry for sure.
Yeah, I would agree with that one. Dirty Harry's a good one. When I put that in, I was like, oh man, I didn't realize Dirty Harry, like you always hear about it. You never really know when these movies came around. Spencer, do you have another one?
I do. Sticking on the theme of boozing. If you could have a drink and a conversation with anybody, dead or alive, present or past, who would that be and why?
That's a big one. Yeah, you'd have to choose wisely with that. I would probably say I didn't get the opportunity to meet and converse with Neil Armstrong. I reckon that would be a pretty damn good conversation.
I would have to agree with that. That would be absolutely incredible. So one last one before we kind of start diving into more of your story. You know, we kind of talked a little bit, or we mentioned your flight hours and all these different aircraft that you have flown, but I won't limit it to just aircraft. I will limit it to either powered, unpowered flight, any type of flight ever. What is your favorite thing that you have ever flown in your entire life?
Yeah, I get asked that a bit, and it's always a hard one because it depends on what your mood is. Because you know, I fly everything from aggressive fighters and race planes through to gliders and hang gliders and helicopters. And it's what matches your mood at the time makes it the best aircraft. But I'd probably say the most romantic and pleasant to fly is probably the Spitfire. It was it's a great plane, so well balanced, and you can visualize a little bit what it was like for those guys back in World War II, and you're doing a roll in a Spitfire, looking out at elliptical wing, going, "This is the real deal."
That's incredible. I can't even imagine having the opportunity to fly a Spitfire. That's pretty awesome. You know, what's funny is you mentioned that, and I remember as a kid, because I grew up around aviation, and as a kid, I had this poster with all the different types of World War II airplanes on it. And I'm sure we've all seen the types of posters from, you know, Allied and you know, all of them from all the different countries up there. And I have a similar one with helicopters too, but you know, it's kind of funny to look at that thinking, you know, back as like a childhood dream, the ability to actually get in the cockpit and fly one of those, which kind of leads me into, you know, talking about your story growing up and, you know, what brought you into aviation. Was it something that you always desired to do?
Yeah, for sure. I guess when I was growing up, I thought I was unique. But as it turns out, it's the path of so many kids out there is that, you know, their dad flies planes and they hung around the airport. Dad's version of babysitting was put the kid in the plane so he could go flying. And I got strapped into some really weird places. Like my dad used to tow gliders in a single seat crop duster. So he'd strap me in basically with a rope to in the hopper. With no seat, no windows, no nothing, and I'd just be hanging on to the engine mount while he took gliders up and down. And it was either going to make me or break me, and it made me. So, and I just started. You know, from that point on, I actually don't remember making a conscious decision that I wanted to be a pilot. It was just for me. It was just always, I am going to be a pilot. You know, so it's and like once again, a lot of young kids, I started flying before I could drive a car. So. You had to get a ride to the airport so I could take the plane flying.
Now, what age was that when you started your initial, you know, dive into flying yourself?
So I started formal lessons when I was 14. So I was flying with my dad the whole time, and you know, he was effectively teaching me. You probably wouldn't say it was legal because he's not an instructor, but just like everyone does. And then when I was 14, I started training with an instructor in a glider and went solo when I was 15. In gliding, you don't really get a license as such. You get ratings as you progress. So I just continued to get ratings in gliding. And then the next thing was ultralights because that was the next age barrier. And that was my first experience with power because my dad bought an ultralight and they're a lot cheaper to run than a powered aircraft. And then I started hang gliding because once again, it was pretty cheap. And then combined all that flying and was able to get my private pilot's license very cheaply I think I was 17 by using all the different forms of flying to only have to do 10 hours to consolidate to get my pilot's license. So it was all done pretty efficiently as a teenager working part-time jobs on the farm to earn pocket money to go flying.
Go ahead, Spencer.
Sorry to cut you off, Nick. What inspired you to go into the military route? Did you have just an inkling to serve, or was it the allure of potentially flying jets, which you ended up doing? Was there any sort of thought process to that?
Yeah, it was. Financially driven because I couldn't afford to fly any other way. My granddad was a pilot in World War II, but didn't continue any flying after that. And, you know, I'd be like any kid go to an air show and you see the fast jets and you're like, man, imagine doing that. It's not, I wonder if I can. It's just, it's even hard to believe that there's a human being in these planes when you watch them go zipping down the runway at 500 knots. You go, surely there's not actually a person in that. It's just a piece of machinery. And I actually didn't think I had the ability to do it. I was like, well, I'm not good enough. You know, you got to be a superhero. You got to be a knight in shining armor, and you've got to be you know, officer and a gentleman and all that sort of stuff to have the opportunity to do that. And it wasn't until and then I was doing my flying, trying to get my commercial license, which was not going so well for financial reasons. And I actually met an old World War II Spitfire pilot who he was telling me all about his stories. And I was like absolutely amazed by this Spitfire pilot that he was talking to me. And then he said, I'd cash it all in a heartbeat to be in your shoes right now so I could have a crack at flying these amazing jet fighters. He goes, I can't imagine how cool it'd be to rip around in a supersonic jet fighter. And I realized as a teenager, like this guy wants to be me to do what I have the potential to do, but I'm not doing it because, and the only reason that I'm not doing it is because people told me I can't, I haven't got the ability. So I thought rather than spend the rest of my life wondering if I could do it, I'd rather find out for myself. And, you know, the only thing worse than failure is actually not knowing if you could have. So I went for it.
Now for, you know, because most of our listeners understand the way the U.S. military works and that you have to, you know, go to college, get your education, and then you can apply for X, Y, or Z pathways into the military officer and flight school side of that. How exactly does that work in Australia? In Australia, do you have that same sort of process or is there more of a direct entry bit?
Yeah, so we have that process for the majority of people joining the military and becoming a pilot, but there is a different avenue, which is the one I took. So I was offered to go and get a degree, but I was, you know, a bit of a country lad that was, I just wanted to fly planes. And so I went for the shortcut route and was fortunate enough to make it work, which is I joined the military, spent 13 weeks learning how to salute and how to march and how to make my bed and how to iron my uniform, and then started flying training as a teenager. So it was only 18 months after I signed on the dotted line and joined the military, I had my wings and I was posted to fly fighters from that point. So it was a bit of a shortcut, which meant I was a very young fighter pilot, which then led to me being a young instructor. And, you know, I was quite often instructing people who were older than me who had gone the long route.
Now, just to kind of gauge, you know, what age were you when you earned your wings?
19, I believe. Yeah, so...
That is pretty wild. How are some of those experiences for you being, you know, so young, having to instruct, you know, these older people? Was there a little bit of a barrier to entry there for them, you know, being willing to listen to you as an instructor, or was there kind of an innate respect because they respected the position? You know, how was that experience for you in a role as a teacher?
Yeah, I didn't see any problems with it at all. One thing I learned about the military as opposed to civilian life, you know, I've been in civilian life now for a bit over a decade. And what I realized in the military is age actually has zero bearing in the military. It's rank. Rank is part of it, but that is often a false form of respect that people like, oh, I have to say, sir, I have to salute, even though I don't really respect you. But it's qualifications and ability is the overriding factor. So because I was older than some of the students, the fact that I was qualified and good at doing what I did, it didn't matter. It wouldn't have mattered if I was 10 years old. Yeah, you respect qualifications and ability. In the military, it comes through in spades. And that's the thing I've discovered in civilian life. It often comes through with jealousy or put downs, or you don't deserve it or anything like that. So it's one of the massive parts of the military that I loved and miss, is that absolute level of respect, loyalty, and follow me into harm's way. You know, that those guys would have followed me into harm's way, and I was younger than them. So that's one of the coolest things I reckon about the military.
So, you know, looking specifically at you know, you're here, you're 19, you earn your wings. Did you select the F-18 or were you sort of assigned to it? Did you have options as to what you were going to go fly? How did that look for you and how did you make your, you know, your personal decision?
Yeah, so I must admit when I was probably 14 or 15, I went and saw a movie called Top Gun. And I watched that and I went, hell yeah, that's me. I was like, imagine doing that. And then that's when I went, oh, I probably can't, you know, you've got to be a movie star to do that sort of stuff. Then when I started my pilot training, I went, you know what, that's the ultimate dream. And I finally admitted it to myself, you know, because often you don't admit things to yourself because you're scared that you set yourself up for failure or people pointing a finger going, oh, I can't believe you thought you were going to do that. Look at you. Of course you can't. So I finally admitted to myself and to people, it's like, yeah, I actually do want to fly fighters. I want it a lot. So we've got a pretty small air force in Australia. You know, there's only 70 odd fighters in the country. So and there's typically only about 40 or 50 fighter pilots at any one time. So it's a pretty unique group of people. So to get that, you have to be top of your pilot's course. So I just decided the only way to make this work is I have to be at the top of my pilot's course. So for that 18-month period of training, I worked my ass off, graduated at the top of the class, and which meant basically the top of the class gets to select where they go. So obviously I selected the fighters and off I went.
Incredible. It's sort of similar, at least as far as the Army is concerned here. Usually top three, you have a choice based on how many aircraft are available. And after that, you're sort of at the whim of the Army. Can you walk us through a little bit? So you select the jets, you're about 19, you got your wings. You had a pretty long career, right? I believe you served around 18 years. I know there's some Top Gun sprinkled in there at some point. What did your career look like leading up to that?
So I finished off with the pilot training. Then I actually ended up taking about, I think it was about 2 years to get onto the Hornet, because we'd had our lead-in fighter was the Mackie, and we'd had a wing failure. A wing had come off one of the aircraft and killed the pilot about 6 months prior to my graduation. So the Mackies were grounded, so we'll put all the young fighter pilots were put in a holding pattern flying the PC-9, which is a turboprop, which prior to joining pilot's course, that was going to be the best plane he'd ever flown. But when you're waiting to go on a fighters, the PC-9 is a disaster. You're like, oh, this thing is so slow and so, you know, can't even shoot a gun or drop bombs. What am I doing here as a 20-year-old? But I hung out in that training pool for about, as I say, a year or two. They got the Mackies sold, flew the Mackie, and then onto the Hornet from there. I did a six-month operational conversion on the F-18, and then I went through to do a couple of tours in squadrons here. And then was selected to go on our weapons, like our Top Gun school, which is another 6 month course on the F-18 to graduate as a weapons officer. So basically, you know, the best of the best side of things, and be a tactics development and tactics instructor on the F-18.
Now, you already said there's a very limited amount of fighter pilots in Australia. Within that number, how many are actually weapons and tactics instructors?
At any one time, there'd probably be 7 or 8 active. Wow. There'll be others in ground jobs. But yeah, when I graduated from my FCI course, I was the 125th graduate in history. So there's not a lot of us.
That's pretty incredible.
Yeah, it's incredible.
So kind of diving in a little bit more into your career, as an F-18 pilot, you four deployed to support operations over in Iraq. Kind of what was that experience like for you as a fighter pilot supporting those operations kind of at the height of the war? And how are you guys kind of integrated into the big picture, you know, under, you know, NATO operations? What did that look like for you guys?
Yeah, it actually ended up being a bit more convoluted than that, because what happened is I was a weapons officer and got selected to go on an exchange program to the United States Air Force. So I was sent over, actually arrived in America in December of 2001, just after the 9/11 attacks. And it was to fly F-15E Strike Eagle. So I had to do a conversion onto the F-15E. Then I had to do a backseat conversion because I was going over there to instruct as well. So I did my front seat, my backseat conversion. And then the unit I was going to then deployed to the Middle East for Operation Iraqi Freedom. And initially I wasn't allowed to attend because I was still an Australian officer attached to an American unit that's going to war. But the Australian Air Force did send over some F-18s, as you mentioned. And because Australia was then involved in that conflict, I, as an Australian, was allowed to participate in that conflict. So I was shipped off immediately to join my squadron in the Middle East, my F-15 squadron in the Middle East, which happened to be at the same base as the F-18 squadron. So it was bizarre that I'm flying F-15s in a war with the guys that were my students flying F-18s in the building next door in the same war. It was quite unique. But the way the Hornets integrated, they were, we trained. The reason I was doing the exchange is we're always trying to cross-pollinate the United States Air Force, United States Marine Corps, United States Navy, the Royal Australian Air Force, the Royal Air Force. We always got exchange programs rotating so that we're making sure that we're all flying the same tactics, using the same language, so that if there is a coalition event like Operation Iraqi Freedom where there's multiple countries involved, that we all know what each other's doing. We're not like, oh, what's that? Or we can actually join on someone's wing from a different country and we just click and it works. And so Australia turned up with their Hornets and were fitted straight into the operations initially as a backstop, not going into harm's way as much. Australia, as I said, is a small air force and attrition is unacceptable for our air force unless it's like, they're invading Australia itself. We can't afford to lose jets and pilots. Whereas the United States Air Force and Army and Marine Corps and Navy have a higher risk profile where losses are generally acceptable in combat and expected, which means we go into harm's way and we expect to get shot at and we expect we're going to lose people. And that was the mentality of the United States Air Force in the squadron I was in.
Now, to kind of gauge the timeline of when this was, what year did you forward deploy to Iraq with that squadron?
It was March, April, 2003. So I got there just before the fighting started. So I arrived in country, actually airlined in, believe it or not, which was kind of bizarre, flying in an airline into the Middle East on a Middle Eastern airline, clean shaven with a bag carrying my G suit and my helmet and my gas mask. It's like, hi, guess why I'm here? Joined my squadron, did some briefs, did one local area familiarization sortie, and then flew operations, and then flew the shock and awe sortie, the strike, the first wave strike into Iraq.
That's what I was going to ask, because there are some, on our side, and most people can go out and find the video, because there are some videos on YouTube out now. They weren't available for a long time of some of the cockpit recordings, and especially on our side, they use a lot of that to teach, especially looking at, the near peer and peer peer type of conflicts. The last time that really anybody faced some of the surface to air threats were during those initial days of Iraq. And it's pretty eye opening, and definitely listening to some of the audio of those missions, kudos to you, hats off, because that's a totally different type of environment and different type of flying that that myself, none of us probably from today's standpoint really understand or can replicate or fully understand, because we just haven't been through anything like what that was. So that's really incredible.
Yeah, it must be. I remember the first time I got shot at, and I was actually in a dive pass, still quite high, and a AAA cloud exploded just here. And my first thought was like, that's unusual for a big black cloud to be in the middle of a nice sunny day. What the hell's a thunderstorm cloud just appeared here? And then my next reaction was, that's AAA. And then my next thought is, why the hell are they shooting at me? And then you realize, oh, that's because I'm dropping bombs on them. So fair's fair. I better start defending, because they're probably going to keep shooting at me because I'm still dropping bombs on them.
Now, do you feel like, kind of given the position, that you brought up of the Australian Air Force side, were you able to take those experiences back, or do you feel like those experiences that you gained being attached to the United States Air Force and being part of that operation, you were able to use to really effectively teach the Australian guys that maybe weren't forward effect, doing the same mission set at that time?
Definitely. The guys that were there from the Australian Air Force that were over fighting got a huge amount of experience, and they took that back themselves. But there were other things I was able to bring back into Australia post my exchange, because, we were using a targeting pod and night vision goggles in theatre that were, Australians weren't using night vision goggles at all, and the targeting pod that Australia was using was a bit more limited than what we were using the Eagle. When I got back into the country, Australia was just purchasing that same targeting pod and getting the night vision goggles that I'd been using while in the desert. So I actually became responsible for integrating and helping to integrate the night vision goggles into the Australian tactics, into the training, the tactics, and then also how to most effectively use the targeting pod and the Link 16 system that was being incorporated, which was all the things I was using on the Eagle in combat. We were actually able to turn the Hornet effectively into a mini strike Eagle. You know, the load and the fuel load was lacking, but the systems and the capability ended up being the same as the Eagle I was flying in combat. So it was pretty satisfying to be able to come back and help that, along with helping people understand, you know, because you always train for threat defense, you know, being shot at. Everyone's always training for it. But as you said, it doesn't actually happen that often that you actually get shot at. So I had that experience to say, well, you know, the training's actually pretty effective. This is actually what it looks like. I found this, I did that. This was different to the training. And being able to put that back into the training session within Australia, I think was invaluable for Australia, and it was satisfying for me to feel I was potentially saving young aviators' lives in the future.
100%. Talking on the training aspect of that, when you were first shot at, going back a few minutes ago, did you find that you instantly kicked into what you had been drilling and training? What was that
like? Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I kept that footage because it was, you know, it's still, for me, it's a bit spine tingling. And it was such an integration into training that it was so automated that immediately after it, I couldn't remember the details of it. And you know when you have an absolute focus zone moment, you actually can't remember 30 seconds ago because you were so focused, to the point where I was going, I can't remember if I did everything right. And for me, I'm like, I might have been squealing on the radio like a little girl. I just don't know. So I actually went into the debrief quite concerned that I had a pretty unique voice in the United States Air Force. I was the only Aussie. And I was like, there's going to be this Australian voice squealing like a little girl on the radio, like, ah. And as it turned out, it was absolutely by the letter of the law, calm. Every maneuver was flown extremely well, calm voice. AAA being fired, defending right, targeting, and my backseater, because it was two-seater, the Strike Eagle, had so much confidence in me that it's, and once again, this just goes to that earlier comment I had where follow you into harm's way. He guided a weapon in while I was defending against active AAA exploding me. He didn't come off, and he guided the weapon in and hit the target while we're getting shot at. And you go, that is the definition of trust, loyalty, mm-hmm. and teamwork.
That's incredible.
An incredible experience. Your backseater, was that U.S. Air Force or was he Australian as well?
No, so he was a U.S. Weapons Systems Officer. Yeah, it was the partnerships we developed. Every now and then you get a wizzo that you'd probably rather have the additional fuel than him in the back. every job in the world's got one of them. But Most of them were force multipliers.
That's understandable. We all have those. I've probably been the same person in the other seat at some point in time.
We all have.
Absolutely. You know, kind of looking a little bit, one, it's funny that you mentioned, and before we go into the next thing, it's funny you brought up Link 16, because in the last couple of years, the Army's still trying to figure out how to effectively use it. And it's been around that long. But I digress. That's a whole separate issue. You know, kind of talking about those people that, you know, we've worked with and that we've developed relationships with and mentorships with, or those people that either look to us as mentors or that we look to as mentors, something that, you know, I kind of, as we were obviously doing our research prior to coming into this, something I noticed on your page was that you have Bob Hoover listed as one of your mentors. And I really wanted to know, like, did you have the pleasure of meeting Bob Hoover and getting to interact with him, and how was that, if so?
I did meet him once. You know, he didn't ask for my number and give me any phone calls afterwards, but so he wouldn't call us best mates, but I did get to meet him. And I guess probably why I put that is I guess the part that I really appreciated with him, and I've got lots of mentors for different points in my life and different purposes. And for him, what it was is how to stay humble. A man who achieved amazing things, a leader of his field, and you never saw him beat his own chest. He was always polite, respectful, reaches out, shakes your hand, introduces himself as though you have no idea who he is. And I think that's a fantastic thing for people who achieve greatness. Should always assume that there's someone else better than them and always continue to listen and learn regardless of what they've already achieved.
Absolutely. And for those who don't know who Bob Hoover is, if you want to learn more about him and his story, to really understand kind of the impact that Matt's talking a little bit about, what he had on aviation and how humble he was for what he did. He wrote a book called Forever Flying that really talks about his story growing up flying Cubs. And he actually, the semantics aside, he worked a lot with Chuck Yeager in the process of breaking the sound barrier. And had it not been for, you know, one or two flights difference, he very well could have been the person to break the sound barrier just as much as Chuck Yeager did. But it's an absolutely awesome book and highly recommend everybody to go read it to kind of gain some perspective on who he was. And that's incredible. I saw that and immediately stuck out to me because, you know, I read that book growing up and exactly what you said really stood out in terms of, you know, how humble he is for all that he did for aviation and all of his accomplishments to have, you know, for his name not to be a household name in aviation is just wild to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
So kind of speaking of people going fast and breaking the sound barrier, regardless of whether or not you guys do, we're going to talk a little bit about the Red Bull Air Race and how you got into it and what drew you to it. Because that I think is something very foreign to all of us in terms of how it works and how you would even get into that pathway of racing airplanes. But I'm very interested to hear, you know, what was your pathway into deciding, hey, I'm going to go time trial airplanes through pylons across the world?
Yeah. So, it was actually while I was in America on my exchange program, I came back off, the combat ops and then went to instructing on the F-15. And, while that is an amazing experience, everything in life is like, ranked. And so I've just come off combat and I'm then teaching people how to drop bombs on a training range, just going, what's the next thing I'm aiming at? What's my next challenge? So I actually took up aerobatic competitions to challenge myself. I think you always need something in life as a challenge. Otherwise, you start to give up trying. So I started doing aerobatic competitions and then came back to Australia and kept doing them. And then I went on to the Hornet, back doing stuff on the Hornet. And it was like, it's good. I love being in the military, but what's the next thing? And I went to a Red Bull Air Race in Perth, and I got talking to some of the pilots there. Because I went there as a fighter pilot representing the military. We had some jets there. Got talking to some of the pilots, and they're like, "Hey, you should come for a fly in the 2-seater." I'm like, "Oh, it's all right. I own something like that, and I already fly aerobatics." They're like, "You're the guy we're looking for. Yeah, we're looking for an Australian. We're looking for someone that's got a unique background and already does aerobatics." They're like, "Why don't you try out?" My first thought was, no way in the world, because you guys have got a screw loose. Look what you do out there. But I got chatting with them and then saw what their future vision was. Because this was back in 2006. Saw their future vision, saw their safety protocols they put in place, saw how they were always on this improvement program. And I must admit, I was thinking about what's my next move in life. Because for me in the military, my next move was a ground job. I was a wing commander, lieutenant colonel. I hadn't had a ground job. I'd been flying the whole time. It's like, I'm facing a ground job. And I'm not that sort of guy. So, I started doing some training with them and turned out I liked it. They liked me. They gave me an opportunity to race, so I took it with both hands and resigned from the military.
Now, kind of can you explain kind of the setup of a Red Bull Air Race? Because I think when a lot of people think air races, they think like Reno Air Race. Can you kind of explain how the races itself work?
Yeah, so there's only one aircraft on the track at a time. It's a time trial. That's done for safety reasons because unlike Reno, where everything is in a constant high-speed single-direction left-hand turn effectively around the pylons and you're above the pylons, in the Red Bull Air Race, we have to be below the level at the top of the pylon and we are changing directions rapidly. We're changing direction at up to 12G, 400 degree a second roll rate. So we are changing directions incredibly fast. And if you had two planes in there together, there's no way that you could keep them separated in those rates of change. Even just hitting your own wash in the second lap, it gets your attention, let alone some other aircraft's wash. So it's all based on time trials. You've got a set speed you have to meet on, or you can't go over 200 knots on entry into the track. And then from that point, you've got to fly in the band between the top of the pylon and the colored band around the pylons and go as fast as you can, limit it to 12G, which is actually a fair bit of G. And then it's two laps of the track and then it's a knockout, you know, head-to-head knockout. Two guys go in, one guy progresses. Two guys go in, one guy progresses. You gather up the winners, time trial again, knockout, and then you go into the third round, which is like a fight for the win. And then that moves all around the world. And at the end of the year, they create a world champion who's got the most points from the season.
Now, talking about 12 Gs, you know, and no more than 200 knots on entry, what kind of aircraft are you guys using to accomplish these? And is it similar to, I don't want to say like NASCAR, but stock car racing where the aircraft are all kind of predictated or like they're all the same? Do manufacturers have say into the development of faster aircraft or different engines, or is it kind of a level playing field and just on the pilot skill?
You nailed it. Actually, it's almost exactly like NASCAR, that it's based on the chassis of a production aircraft. Most of the aircraft, so there's really in the end only two aircraft that were being used. Called one's the Zivco Edge and one's the MXS. And to the untrained eye, they look almost the same. They're a single seat aerobatic plane that's been highly modified for aerodynamics and power, and the manufacturer has input into what we can do with the aircraft because they have to sign off on any mods that are done, and the air race has a set of rules this thick about what's allowed to be done, what has to be done, what modifications are required to make it a race aircraft, because we had to have pylon cutters so that we didn't lose controls. We had to have egress systems in place for canopies. We had to have oxygen bottles. If we go in the water, we were on scuba masks. All these things were dictated. The weight of the aircraft was set between a minute and a max. All the telemetry of how it was attached to the aircraft, had cameras drilled into the aircraft. And in the end, the teams that put the most effort into the aerodynamic package got an advantage. But in the end, it really does come down to the pilot, because the fastest plane could have a pilot making mistakes and it doesn't matter. But the fastest pilot with a plane without the mods isn't going to win.
You know, that's an incredible description. And there are two things that you said that really stand out to me. One is the oxygen bottles in case you hit the water, which we'll touch on in a second. And two is just the sheer ability of the pilots, you know, where pilot skill is always going to win. And I think that a win in certain situations that you guys go through in these races is, you know, keeping the horizon above you, you know, one of those particular being the 2010 Ontario Red Bull Air Race, where during the qualifier, you kind of had a little bit of an incident. Can you talk a little bit about what happened, how you recognized and addressed that situation, and kind of share that experience with our listeners?
Yeah, so 2010 was a year where I lost focus on what was important in life, and I started focusing on results as opposed to process, discipline, and routine. And that comes in life, comes in competition, where you start getting greedy for results and start trimming corners. And it's exactly what I was going through in 2010. I had a new team, a new plane. I wanted to win. I was hungry for winning. And I got distracted from focusing on my job is to fly the plane safely and efficiently. And I was trying to do everyone else's job for them. I was trying to modify the plane aggressively. And then in the end, with a heap of my own pressure put in my head, mental stress, fatigue, all those things combined that I wasn't focused correctly when I went into the track that day. I came around a corner and G-stalled the aircraft, which means exceeded its critical angle of attack. The wing can't fly anymore, which stalled the aircraft and rolled it slightly onto its back. We were only at 30 feet when this happened, doing about 160 knots. I was probably at about 10 G. I got the aircraft flying again as it was falling out of the sky from 30 feet, which happens pretty quick. I got it rolled back upright, but contacted the water as I was doing so with the left wing tip, and then the right-hand landing gear and the right wing tip all contacted the water quite aggressively. I lost about 30 or 40 knots of airspeed as I hit the water and came back out of the water. I was actually thought I was staying in, and I thought I was going to flip. So I was actually trying to stabilize the aircraft so it didn't flip, and it flew out. And I was like, okay, it's flying. I'll take it. And I was heading towards the crowd at the time because it was the direction I was turning in. So I reversed away from the crowd. And my initial thought is I've got 10 seconds left in this aircraft before it gives up on life. So I just started climbing to take everything I could out of it before I had to bail out or ditch it in the river. As it turned out, I didn't do as much damage as I thought I did, and I was able to fly it back to the airfield and land it.
That is wild, especially hearing, you know, having seen that video clip. And I actually remember seeing that video clip years ago when I was watching videos on the Red Bull Air Race, not knowing that years later we would have you sitting right here talking about that experience. But, you know, kind of looking at your career in the military and those, you know, natural instincts that kicked in, even, you know, during the shock and awe mission, do you feel like that experience that you gained from the military and knowing, you know, those innate abilities kind of kicked in that same way where it's not really a thought process? It just, it happens really without even thinking about it.
For sure. You know, there's jokes around when I was joining the military, and I'm sure they're still there, that, you know, monkeys fly planes. But it's true. It's what keeps you alive. Is you just need people that are, it's repetitive training so that when things go wrong, the monkey's reactions take place. You know, when things go wrong in a plane, you haven't got time. It's like that line in Top Gun. You haven't got time to think. You have to react with everything you've been taught. You just have to let it happen. Because if you try and assess what's going on in a time critical emergency, yeah, there's times that you have to sit and think. But with a time critical emergency like that, you have to let instinct and training take over and not try and not overthink it. And that's that whole monkey see, monkey do thing from the military, is repetitive training of see this, do this, see this, do this, see this, do this. And exactly what happened. Plane stalled, get it flying again, get your wings level. Boom, it hits the water. It's like nothing I can do about that. And then it's flying again. Okay, next thing is, get it away from the crowd, get everything out of it until it's like, hey, I might actually be able to land this. But it's just not be in denial, not try and fight what you can't fight, and only fight what you can fight, and let instinct and training take over.
Now, you kind of mentioned that year as a whole, kind of having lost focus a little bit through that 2010 season. Do you want to talk about how post that incident, kind of how that season changed and how that changed how you were moving forward from learning, you know, hey, maybe I need to refocus around that. Like, what did that look like for you post that incident?
Yeah. So post that incident, there's obviously a lot of questions asked. You know, the air race said, you know, Matt, you crashed your plane, you know, naughty boy, don't do it again. But for me, I had to, you know, there's no way I can go and put myself in a situation again with my fingers crossed going, I hope that doesn't happen, you know. And that's, once again, the military thing. You go, debrief, why did it happen? You know, what caused it? What were the contributors? What were the indicators? How can we recognize this again? How can we stop it happening again? You know, digging right down deep into making sure that never happens again. Because if I went into the track again, I had to be very confident I was the person least likely for that to happen to now. So it was an in-depth debrief personally. And what it came down to was all mindset. You know, my mindset was completely wrong. I'd forgotten about what are the priorities of life. You know, I wasn't trying to kill myself, but I'd forgotten that it is a dangerous activity if you're not focused. So we restructured the team, talked about who's responsible for what. And it was a hard situation because I'm the team owner, I'm the team boss, but I'm also the pilot. So we realized that I had a conflict of interest as I was going into the race, that I'm trying to tell everyone what to do and keep everything managed and also get in the plane of flight. So we set up, you know, basically a military structure in the team. So, you know, to the point where we had a temporary commanding officer, when we deployed, I would hand over the keys to the squadron, to the temporary commanding officer, and I would become just a line driver. I was just the pilot. The tactician would tell me what to do, and I'd say, yes, yes, boss, and I'd go do it. I had to stop being a boss when I was executing in the seat. The other thing we did was just how to prioritize in life. And that was an easy one for me. All I did is I just imagined my son's school principal pulling him out of school saying, sorry, mate, I've got to give you some bad news. Your dad just hit the ground. And you get, boom, all of a sudden my priorities are right. That's just a job. I want to watch my son grow up. So it just clarified everything in my head that, you know, this is just a job. It should be fun. And I'm just going to go out and fly planes and let everyone else worry about how the squadron's functioning.
That's, you know, and that's some really incredible insight. And so after that 2010 season, 2011 to 2013, you did not race, or you did race?
No, so air race stopped for those years. There were some financial things going on with the air race. There was some there were actually a couple of accidents that year, and they went, right, we're losing the ability to control this thing, because, you know, the air race started off as just a bit of a marketing campaign for Red Bull, like, woohoo, check this out, and it turned into this amazing sport that people were following, and they weren't structured correctly for the risk levels and the procedure, so they shut down for a few years. Rebuilt the whole procedure. Then we came back in 2014 and started racing with more safety conscious for sure, and a better structure to how the whole thing was running.
Right. And then in 2015 and 16, you went back to back for second place, another second place in 2018. And then in 2019, you took the world championship. Do you want to talk a little bit about that 2019 season and kind of, you know, what that looked like for you in that lead up, and was, you know, what was that culminating moment that you were like, you know, I'm going all in to do this, and I'm going to take the top spot. Like, what did that look like for you?
Yeah. So, you know, I've got to admit that I'm a competitive person, and it was a disturbing trend to come second three times. It's like three times the bridesmaid, and you never really remember who came second, do you? So it was frustrating at times, but that whole prioritization thing, I had to keep reminding myself that, yeah, because sometimes you feel like throwing the towel and you're like, you know, screw this, coming second every time. And it was always to someone different. So someone else would pop up, have their day in the spotlight and fall off. And then, but I'm always the guy coming second. So I was Mr. Consistency in second place. And as I say, I felt like throwing the towel in a few times, and I had to reach back to young Matt. 10-year-old Matt going, hey, dude, guess what I do for a job? I travel the world, I race planes, but I'm going to throw in the towel because I keep coming second in the world. And 10-year-old Matt would kick my ass going, are you kidding me? You're throwing in the towel for the best job in the world and you're ranked number two in the world? How good's that? So perspective once again to go, right, you know what? It's coming first isn't everything. I want to, but I just have to do my best. So 2019 was another one of those years where you go, you know what, just came second. Doesn't matter. All we can do is do our best. And if you always try your best, it doesn't matter what the result is. But if you are doing your best and you are at the top of your field, at some stage the cards will align and you will be recognized as the best. And so that's what we did. We just continued to be our best. We didn't compete with anybody. Whenever we were up against a head-to-head, we didn't even look at who I was flying against, because it didn't matter. Because if you're going to be the world champion, it shouldn't matter who you're competing against, because you're the best. So it doesn't matter who it is. You're going to beat them. And that was our attitude. It's like, don't worry about who the competitor is. Do our best as a team. And if we lose while doing our best, we've still done our best. So it means you can walk over and shake the hand and go, well done. You earned that, because I did my best. And it keeps good sportsmanship, but it keeps the motivation up. And when we finally won the world championship, it was a relief. It was like, whew, finally I got that monkey off my back. But it was a team effort, and it was a team effort of just focusing on being your best, and that's all you can be.
That's really incredible. And And what a testament in terms of perspective of somebody that stayed after it for years and years and years with humility, but understanding, you know, we've gotten second, we can be there, but we have to change our perspective and beat ourselves rather than worrying about what anybody else is doing. What a great piece of insight. That's probably applicable to all of us, regardless of our field or really what we're doing. So kind of looking beyond 2019, what is 2020 and beyond looked like for you, in terms of, you know, what are you up to these days? What does the future for Matt Hall look like, and, kind of where are you going?
Yeah. So, it's at 2019 was the last race we had. Red Bull actually sold the air race to another company, and then the pandemic hit. So we haven't actually raced since then. I'm still hoping that one day we do, but you know, as you mentioned, we're not bringing age into it, but someone that was born in 1971, it's getting harder every day to go and jump in a plane and race and pull 12G. I hope racing does come back, and I'd like to do it again for another year or two, because it'd be great to defend my title. But in the meantime, you know, because I'm not one to sit around and get bored. So in the meantime, we set up, probably as it turns out, too much going on back here in Australia. We bought an airfield. We started doing experiences in our two-seat race plane. We do demonstrations still in the single-seater. We've got a charter business, so we bought a King Air, and we're doing flying people around Australia. I do motivation talks and corporate speaking and ambassador work. So we've got a lot going on. And it's all revolves around aviation and, you know, utilizing my military background for the motivation talks and everything. And I guess in the end, what is it that I enjoy doing? I enjoy employing people and giving them opportunity is actually one of the things I really enjoy. It's one of my motivations for making the businesses work, is that I've got a lot of young team members who are living their best life. And so my motivation is to keep this thing growing, so I can keep them living their best life. Every time, you know, when they go and buy a new car or they go and buy a house, I'm super proud that, you know, I'm helping that occur. I enjoy helping people is what it comes down to in the end. And motivation talking is, and you know, doing podcasts like this, I don't see the result. You know, I don't get to see the crowd listening to this podcast. But what I do get is feedback years down the track. Someone will say, hey, I saw that, and it changed my life, and that's an amazing feeling. So that's, yeah, fingers crossed racing comes back. But if it doesn't, my objective moving forward is to change people's lives for the better.
No, I was just going to say, this is by far my favorite episode that we've done. There's been so many wisdom bombs that have dropped, regardless of what your career is. It doesn't have to be aviation, that is applicable to anybody that listens to this. So, Matt, I really just want to thank you for taking an hour of your day to sit here and chat with a couple of knuckleheads like us and share your experiences with us. It means a lot.
Yeah, my pleasure.
So something that we typically ask all of our guests, regardless of, you know, we've had people who are pilots, people who are, you know, professional athletes. And I would say as an air racer, you're a little bit of a blend of both of those, given that your body's going through 12 Gs, to say the least. But, you know, what would be your piece of advice for any pilot, military or civilian, to succeed in stress management or high tension environments in the aircraft, especially given, you know, some of those experiences between the 2010 incident and, you know, being shot at during, you know, the shock and awe mission in Iraq? What would be your piece of advice for someone who's maybe a younger pilot like myself or Spence or any other person that is going into that, whether it's being shot at or dealing with an emergency in the middle of it happening? You know, what would your advice to them be to be successful?
I think it all comes down to preparation. So preparation can be in a lot of forms. You know, it's training, it's repetition, it's simulators, but preparation in the end. So that's all the physical side of things, but preparation in the end is your mental state. So I think if I reach back to talk to myself or any younger pilot, what I'd be saying is that prepare for the unexpected, but once you go into the mission, execute with absolute belief of success. So you're always on the front foot while executing. You're not defensive, because if you're defensive, things overwhelm you. So lean forward with a mindset of absolute belief of success when you're executing, in the preparation phase, that's where you deal with the stressful situations of thinking, what if, what'll I do, how will I do it? And then put it aside, lean forward and go.
Matt, thank you so much. It has been an absolute honor to have you on the podcast. I'm glad that we were able to get a hold of you and get this scheduled. It's been a really awesome experience to hear your story and to, like Spencer said, to just be able to try to soak in some of that wisdom. And we know that our listeners are really going to benefit from everything that you've shared with us as well today. So thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me, guys.